anything that's not clear. Anyway, what I'd like to do today, and this is not going to be real long, but I'd like to talk about Zen practices in our daily lives. Peter Matheson, the writer, and he's now deceased, Zen master, called this idea of Zen practice in daily life, he called this social action Zen. And another important Zen teacher, Bernie Glassman, calls Zen practice in our daily lives living a life that matters. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to rely on a manual for Dogen. Most of you all know who Dogen is? Okay. Dogen, in the 13th century, wrote a manual on monastery rules for the temple at Heiji. And the first chapter of that is called Tenzo Kyokun, which in English translates to Instructions to the Chief Cook. So I'm going to use this a little bit, some of the points from this. And okay, you might be wondering right now, what's the relevance of a 13th century set of instructions for a Japanese monastery cook? And what does that have to do with living in the 21st century? Well, on one level, the manual is about the proper ways to cook and serve meals to monks, obviously. But on a deeper level, it describes really how we function in the world, how we live a life that matters for all living beings. Now, a chief cook in a monastery, in a Zen monastery, is a very important position. There are six major officers in a monastery, and one of them is the chief cook, the Tenzo. And this position is a position that is not offered to just anybody. It has to be a monk who has a very deep spiritual practice. He's got a mature practice, and it's a very deep spiritually. So, the next question might be, what's the connection between a deep spiritual practice and the practical necessity of preparing meals? Or another way to look at it, what's the connection between the practice of Zazen, sitting still in a quiet room, and performing our day-to-day jobs at work and in our lives? What's this connection? And the reason I brought this up, because a couple of times I've had people come in and they've had a quandary about, they're relatively new to Zen, and they have a quandary about how when they begin meditation, how do you fit this meditation into your daily schedule? They struggle to figure out how they add something into their lives, and then they wonder how you take the mind of meditation, that spirit of meditation, and how does that fit into your daily life? What does Zazen have to do with sweeping floors or operating a copy machine? So, I want to just explore that a little bit, but to examine that, I'd like to start out and just talk a little bit about why people come to Zen in the first place. And a lot of people come because they feel they're missing something in life. There's an anxiousness, an unfulfilledness. They are hungry, in a way. I know personally that's why I came to Zen practice. I was in my 40s. I had worked hard to develop a successful profession and to take care of my family. And then all of a sudden, I'm having this midlife crisis trying to figure out, well, there's something missing in my life. There's something, and that's why I decided to come to Zen. But there's a lot of other reasons why people come here. A lot of times people come to Zen because, oh, they've been pursuing other things in their lives, and then they all of a sudden realize that they're in a financial crisis and they haven't paid attention to their livelihood, so they come to Zen to kind of get themselves together, get straightened out. Other people come, and I'm sure you know examples of this, they come here because of health reasons. You know, everybody knows that meditation lowers your blood pressure, increases your circulation, so on and so forth. Other people come because they want to improve themselves. They want to develop their powers of concentrations. They want to become more aware. And then some people come, and this is not too often, because they want to have the experience of some kind of esoteric, physical happening. You know, they want to go through Kensho, or they want to go through Satori. Well, and I'm sure you can think of other reasons, but the point I want to make is that even though Zen does help with all these kind of things that people come for, in other words, it helps people get their lives back together, it fulfills some spiritual void, it improves psychological conditions, physical conditions, these kind of goals for coming to practice are really quite flawed. It's because the newcomer, or whoever's coming in, sees something that is missing in their life. That's really, from a Zen perspective, nothing is missing from your life. And they're coming from a very relative point of view, a world of dualities where it's everything is us and them. Everything is in opposition to what we might call self or ego. Well, if you sit over time, and I think most of you have realized this, you sit on a regular basis, you allow your thoughts to, and your thoughts and your feelings to rise and fall by themselves, and your mind begins to calm down and you sink into stillness. It's like initially our minds are floating on a surface of a lake where the waves are being agitated by the winds of greed, anger, and ignorance. And then we drop below the chaotic surface, sink down to a deep, clear, calm place in the water level. And in this stillness, we begin to feel and sense a spaciousness, an openness, and a connectedness with all things, moment by moment. And over time, if we continue our practice of Zazen on a regular basis, we begin to experience a world that is different from what we initially expected. I don't know anybody who's come to Zen who hasn't had, who doesn't have an experience or see their experiences as Zen as what they originally expected. I think, and part of this is Emily, our practice, which was so self-centered, self-focused, invariably turns outward from an initial self-consciousness. We start to turn towards an expanded focus on others. It becomes a practice out to the outside, as opposed to me and them. As we mature in our practice of Zazen, our minds settle down and we realize this experience of spaciousness, openness, interconnectedness is all the fundamental reality of our lives. We realize that our existence is all that we experience moment by moment. That's what our existence is, what we are experiencing right now at this moment. There is no past, there's no present, there's a future. It's right now what we're experiencing. We realize this as an eternal present, something that's going on moment to moment to moment, present, 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 present. It's always changing, but it's just as it is. No matter what it is, it's just as it is. The reality of the moment is all that we experience. And so we have a unique universe. Every one of us has a universe that is in our mind that we're experiencing everything. This is in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's a whole chapter on what's called the Buddha field. This is the Buddha field. This is our life. This is what we have. This personal universe that we have, all that we perceive, all that we feel, and everything that we are aware of, and all that we comprehend, this is unique to us and is who we are at any moment. The reality of our personal universe is unique to each one of us because it's based on our own bodily senses. I don't hear as well as I used to. That's part of how I perceive my universe now. It also deals with our past karma, all our past experiences, all the things that make up who we are. no one else's universe, not even your closest friend or your closest family member, has the same universe as you do. And this really is our true self, moment by moment by moment. This is what existence is. When we experience our own world, our Buddha field, in this manner, it's really a life-changing experience. We realize the interpenetration of all beings and all things in our universe. We realize that all things and all beings are important and irreplaceable. And there's no need for comparison, there's no need for points of reference. This is the mind of meditation, of a mature Zen practitioner. This is the mind that Dogen was referring to when he was talking about the chief cook. When the Zen practitioner can bring this mind of meditation, this view of life just as it truly is, when the Zen practitioner brings this mind of meditation off the cushion into an active daily life, it is the moment when absolute reality and relative dualistic reality meet in perfect harmony. This is where we live our lives wholeheartedly. Our activities become an expression of Buddha Dharma, and everything we encounter is part of our living body. Dogen comments that neither a leaf of cabbage nor a stick of firewood exists separate from us. Now there's a little warning with this. Taking the mind of meditation into our daily lives does not mean that you try to do zazen while you're attending to your day-to-day activities. When we're doing zazen, we just do zazen. When we cook, we just cook. When we sweep, we just sweep. And when we drive a car, we focus on our driving, hopefully. Now, as we go about our daily activities and we're trying to hold this mind of meditation, certain activities arise and color the quality of our everyday experiences. Dogen says, quote, "When working in any position, not only as the tenzo, the chief cook, but as a leader and assistant, we strive to maintain a spirit of joy, magnanimous mind, and parental mind, in hopes of incorporating and maintaining them in our everyday life experience." So he's focusing on these three qualities, the attitudes, and I'd like to just look at those for a second. When we're talking about joyful mind, from a Zen perspective in our mind of meditation, this is the satisfaction that springs up from the gratitude and the gratefulness of being able to live an active and engaged life. It is the joy that arises from the gratitude of being able to wholeheartedly pour our energies into everything we encounter, everyone we meet, and all things that we use every day. It's the joy arising when we realize how fortunate we are to be humans and to be alive at this moment in time, to be able to validate our lives by helping other people. It's also the joy when we realize how fortunate we are in knowing that working to benefit others really benefits ourselves. And finally, it's the joy of arises when we realize that we are fortunate in knowing that as we engage in our efforts to make this world a better place, we are really revitalizing our own character. So this joyful mind is going to bed at night happy and satisfied, knowing that you really did your best. Next comes the quality of magnanimous mind. Now, in Japanese, the magnanimous mind is really a translation of Daishin, which means big mind or big heart. And big is not a good word to use here, because when we talk about magnanimous, it's not a matter of comparison. When you start to think of big mind, you start to think, well, there's little mind. There's no comparisons here. So Dogen says that magnanimous mind is like a mountain that is stable and impartial. Magnanimous mind exemplifies the ocean. It is tolerant and it views everything from the broadest experience. Further, he says that magnanimous mind means being unprejudiced and refusing to take sides. Now, in our day-to-day activities, we must pick and choose. We must make relative decisions. But I think what Dogen really means here, and what he's getting at, is that magnanimous mind acts with equanimity. It makes decisions and acts on the reality of the situation without adding biased points of view, pre-existing conditions, and hidden agendas. This is often referred to in Zen as going into the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. Magnanimous mind is not a narrow outlook, but it is impartial. It's not rigid. It's not flighty, but it is stable. It views everything in the broadest perspective to allow for all possibilities and all opportunities. When I was first starting out in Zen, like I think most people, I read Shunryu Suzuki's book on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And in that book, he talks about control. And he said something that was very confusing to me at that time. He says that regarding control, to give a sheep or a cow a large spacious meadow is the best way to control it. Over the years, I've come to think that this large spacious meadow is a good analogy for this broad perspective of magnanimous mind. It allows for creativity and potential of the moment without any kind of fabricated restrictions, things, you know, our own prejudice that we bring to things. I could use a personal experience here, and I'll make this very brief. Before I retired, I was a wildlife ecologist, and I worked as an environmental consultant for several large engineering firms. And when I first started, it was back in the days when the Environmental Policy Act just came out and whatnot. I thought that my job was to be concerned with my client's point of view and work for information and to present it so that it would make him a winner in various conflict situations. Over time, and after I started practicing Buddhism for several years, I eventually realized that this winner-loser mentality, this right and wrong mentality, actually created ongoing problems that was never really solved. It reminds me of having a beach ball, and you put the beach ball under the water, and sooner or later it's going to pop up again. These always, whenever you have these winner-loser situations. So I found in my own professional work eventually that my clients' interests were best served to solve both their environmental and their legal problems by putting aside this dualistic point of view and to try to look for novel situations with a magnanimous mind. So it would satisfy all parties, not just my clients. So, and this simply wasn't a matter of compromising. It's a matter of coming to the table, dropping all preconceptions, looking at the problem, looking at the different points of view, and working to come up with creative solutions. So for me, this is a real reflection of magnanimous mind in my own life. Okay, so we've got joyful mind, we've got magnanimous mind, or big mind, and we have parental mind. This attitude of parental mind, Jobin instructs his chief cook that once he has obtained the ingredients of a meal, he needs to handle them as if he was handling his own eyes. Later he says that a cook needs to handle all the cooking utensils with equal care and awareness, cleaning them and carefully putting them away where they belong. This attitude for parental mind is easy, a quality for parents to understand. A parent, whether they're rich or poor, or whether they're having difficult times or circumstances, raises their child with love and care. The parent is attentive to the child's needs, sheltering them, protecting them, allowing them to grow to their potential. A parent is willing to sacrifice their own needs for the welfare of their child. But parental mind also means being prudent, aware of the child's real needs, and not pandering to the child's every whim. And there's a great paradox, I think, personally, in this idea of a parent, the parent's love for a child. A parent deeply loves a child and feels fulfilled to a certain extent to have the child with him, to be able to hold the child, to have the child close. And yet, everything a loving parent does for a child, from the moment of his birth to when he eventually leaves, is to prepare him for that minute, that time when he will be gone, when he actually leaves the parent, when he becomes a responsible, independent adult. So this is the idea of parental mind. It's something that we bring to everything we handle, everything we experience, everything we see, everyone we meet, everything we do. So, just to briefly summarize, the mind of meditation that we bring to our activities in day-to-day lives is a perspective and a practice of devoting each moment of our life to each and everything you encounter, no matter what it might be. It is the process of wholehearted engagement. We develop attitudes of joyful mind, magnanimous mind, parental mind. And in this way, we manifest our practice and our true selves through cooking this supreme meal and finding fulfillment in a life that matters for all living things. So that's my talk. Anybody has any questions? I'll be glad to try to answer them. But you got to speak up, please. Does this make any sense?
Yes.
It sort of sounds like a textbook rendition of what I suppose we all wish or hope.
The what?
It sounded to me sort of like a textbook rendition of what we all hope or wish happens in the process of us becoming involved with a Zen and meditative practice.
Okay, you lost me at textbook rendition. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
What I mean is that if one reads various tomes, such as Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or anything else really that is by its very nature discursive, because it's written, one can see, okay, you start out at point A, and then you hope that you become more mature in your practice, more able to shut out irrelevancies, obstructions, etc., etc. And of course, some people are better than others at doing that. However, at least in my case, I have found that for the most part, I fail to achieve the kind of things that you were talking about, the sequence of things that leads to serious, mature practice, going out in the world, making the difference that you talked about.
Okay, I guess I can respond to a couple things. The reason I use these references, both Dogen's references or Suzuki's, these are all personal experiences. These people are talking about their personal experiences. This is not ideologically. These are things that happen. And that these are things that develop. Now, in everybody, if you have the inspiration or the aspiration to continue with it, they happen in different ways. And they happen at different times. But basically, these are the processes that happen, and we have the experience of knowing that they happen. So, if I give the impression that this is a kind of a textbook, Zen Buddhism 101, I'm sorry, but this idea of having a matured Zen practice means that you're experiencing your life moment by moment, and everything that's in front of you is that experience. And that is what the reality of the moment is, whether it's good or bad, whether you're in pain or whether you're happy. That's the moment. That's what you have to live with. And that's it. So right. It's very personal. And I'm sorry if it didn't come across that way.
No need to apologize.
I really liked it when you talked about the different universes that everyone has. That everyone has their own world, their own reality. And I remember when my mother died, I think it was about 8 years ago, I just knew that when she died, before I even heard about that concept of all of us having our own worlds, that she took her world with her when she passed on. And I just had that feeling. And the other day I was listening to a lecture, and I think they were talking about the Buddha was sitting, and he saw a star, and he became one with the star, and that's when he realized that the universe was in him, that the world was in him, and he was one with all of that. So that sparked inspiration when you talked about how we all have our own worlds, and that ties in with the personal experience we all have with Zazen, with the Buddha, with our path.
And how we relate to that.
How do
we relate to other people?
Our personal experience.
It's not to say that everything doesn't exist. It does exist, but the reality of our life is what is happening right now, what we can know at this moment. This is particularly interesting to me because I have a grandson that is autistic. And trying to understand his world so that we can respond to that world in a way that he understands is really an interesting process to go through, and reaffirming what your own beliefs are.
Yeah, I love that. And Uchiyama Roshi in the book about that Tenzo Kyokan, the instructions. What is it called? What did they change the name to? Like Cooking Your Life or something like that book?
Yeah,
right. I love that book. It's so underlined in dog ears. It's just like pouring that book out. But there's even a diagram of like a little person and just like a circle around the little stick figure. And this is you. And you includes everything you're experiencing, everything around you. And so that concept of the Buddha looking at the morning star, or the story of the monk that lived in the little hut and a thief came and stole everything he owned. And he said, oh, I wish I could give him this bright moon. You know, it's not a metaphor. It's a real experience. Mm-hmm. It's not a metaphor. And I love that idea of the best way to control the cow is to have the big open field. Because, you know, to comment on what you said about something resonated with me about shutting out irrelevancies, and that's where I get tripped up, is when I'm trying to shut anything out at all. And I'm not saying yes to everything, because that is my experience, even when I'm delusional, even when I'm miserable. And I've been pretty miserable lately, because I have a health problem. And I have been resisting it and pushing against it and saying no, when really the answer has always been to bow, you know, to it. And yes, this is it. And to just not shut anything out. It's impossible to shut anything out. It's like trying to slice up a tray of water. You can't do it.
Yeah, that's a good example.
What was that book you were talking about? That's dog year. That
Uchiyama Roshi.
Refining Your Life.
I think it's called Cooking Your Life.
It's called Cooking Your Life.
Because it used to be called something else, and they re-released it under a different name.
That's right.
But it's about the instructions to the cook. It's just a wonderful book.
It's his commentary.
Yeah, his commentary on Dokken's.
Yeah, that's your example is really an interesting one, in the fact that, you know, when we're suffering, we will be want to try to resist it or shut it out. This is what really causes the suffering. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, this is your life. This is what's going on in your life at this moment. And that's it.
Or when I'm
so
foolish.
How do you do? You bow. You accept. You have to accept this. Mm-hmm. Or else you're going to be miserable.
That just reminded me of when you shut it out, but also when you're expecting. Mm-hmm. And when I first started coming here, I come from a Lutheran background. And so if anybody's been to like a Protestant church, and so I was looking for that interaction and it wasn't here. And so that threw me off a bit. There was a talk about compassion one Sunday, and I thought, well, isn't compassion, you know, just kind of what I experienced in the Lutheran church, you know, and everything. And so I was a little frustrated leaving here and everything, and I felt compassion later on in the day. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing. Then I realized, you know, it. Fortunately, I was open a little bit, you know, and felt that compassion.
Yeah. Compassion is really that, it's that arising of this joyful mind. It's the goal of the compassion arises. Okay. What do we do now?
I think we're done, and see, I don't think we have.
Thank you.
I don't think we have any announcements. Is there anything that we need to? I don't have any. There are people on retreat. They're coming back today, and
well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.